The issue is not screens. The issue is hypocrisy. I just don't understand why parents continue to blame technology instead of themselves. And the second you blame yourself, well, then you can start controlling the outcome you want. We are getting better and better and better and better at pointing fingers. It's the government's fault. It's this religion's fault. It's this tech company's fault. It's this app's fault. It's this influencer's fault. We've gotten so good at blaming absolutely everything but ourselves that we're starting to hit a tipping point. I think we have to start the beginning of a new chapter in modern society. I think it's time to start blaming ourselves. And the second you blame yourself, well, then you can start controlling the outcome you want. But blaming screens, but then not enforcing it in your own home when you have 100% control because you're worried about your child being mad at you for a little while, seems soft. What world do you think your children are gonna be living in? Screens are gonna be amateur hour. If the metaverse is right, which I think it's very hard to see a world of why it would not be right, because I would argue we live in the metaverse now. How many hours are you spending looking at a screen?
7.
So, you know, like, where do you think this is going? I would be flabbergasted if in 60 years people aren't living in a Ready Player One world. It would make no sense to me, other than vacationing out of it. But like, technology only goes in one direction. We're not gonna ride horses down the highway. It's not happening.
So I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Gary Vaynerchuk. Have you ever heard him? I heard a collective. So he is a Russian immigrant. His family moved over here in the 80s when he was a kid from behind the Iron Curtain. And he now runs VaynerMedia, which is one of the fastest growing digital advertising companies in the world. And it's interesting to me that we listen to an advertising executive tell us what we've been trying to tell you over the last couple of weeks, that we are in complete control of this. Or we should be, unless we have given control over to something. And he's a really interesting dude. If you ever listen to him, I like him a lot because he does not care what you think about him. And if you listen to him, you know that is heavily edited because he uses words we don't use in here. So if you're new to PV, if you are new to church, we are happy that you're here. We are smack dab in the middle of a series called Left to Our Own Devices, where we're unpacking and looking at some of the gifts and the blessings of technology over the last 20 or 25 years, and also looking at what do we do to deal with the exhaust of that, this payload of just almost crushing anxiety that everybody is carrying around these days. So today, Gary, that's Stormont 2.0. Jonathan, Stormont 1.0, he has done a great job anchoring us in the first couple of weeks. I'm here to blow all that up, and then he's coming back next week to fix it, okay? So if you'll hang with me, I kind of want to look at two words. Two simple words, because we spend a lot of time demonizing the device, don't we? I mean, we look at it and we, you know, we will always say, look at those kids. They just won't pull their nose out of their phone while we're sitting in our recliner, you know, looking at reels or whatever. But can I just tell you, this isn't new. I got in trouble for screen time when I was a kid. It was just a different screen. We called it television back then. So the reality is, this has been going on for a very long time. I'm going to give you the secret to handling all of this. And we're going to start with two words. And those are the two words, more, faster. Because that's what we want. That's the promise of technology. You can do more, you can do it faster. And that's what we all hope to achieve, right? I mean, the difference in technology today is not that there's new stuff, it's just the rapidity of the technology cycle. Now we get new versions of things before we learn the old version. And it drives us nuts. And we want to dig in our heels and say, well, I'm not updating. And then you've got security concerns and all that. I'm not even going there today. We just want more, faster. And technology enables it. God knew I should not form and let Mark Hodges be born in the 1830s because he will die. I mean, I think beef grows in cellophane, okay? I mean, I don't know. I could not have lived on the Great Plain. I would have died. I enjoy the mix of electricity making silicon do wonderful things. That's just me. But since this has been going on so long, I mean, think about it. It creates this pace that we live at that seems unsustainable. And it's not just technology doing it either. Think back just to the 90s. Citigroup becomes the biggest mortgage lender in the country because they made one promise and they made good on it. Their promise was, we will give you a mortgage in half the time it takes to get it from anywhere else. And they did it. Now, we'll leave that whole 2006 housing crisis thing out for the purposes of this. But, you know, they accomplished it. Denny's. You remember Denny's? We used to have one. I enjoyed a good Moons Over Miami sandwich every now and then. But Denny's rolls out the Express Lunch. They weren't the originals with it. They just made it popular. And the Express Lunch was, you go in, you order your lunch, there's a stopwatch on the table, and the server would click it, and if your lunch didn't get there in 10 minutes, it was... Oh, it was a great promise. I never won at that game, by the way. My food would always show up at some arbitrary time, like 9 minutes, 52 seconds. Close enough where I sat and ate in anger the entire time because I was thinking I was about to get something free, and we're all looking at the stopwatch, and then this plate of food slides in on you. It ticked me off. Domino's rises to fame with a great promise. You get your pizza in 30 minutes or less, or it is... Oh, we love free stuff, don't we? And Domino's just exploded when they did this, and in some weird fit of transparency or honesty won, the Domino's CEO became famous when he said, hey, we don't sell pizza. We sell delivery. And if you've ever eaten Domino's, you know he's right. He told the truth, because that's not pizza. I won't even go into what it might be. But, I mean, we have all come to desire this certain pace in life, haven't we? We want it fast. We want it quickly. Sometimes we want it on demand. We want it curated to us. And does technology enable that? You betcha. But today I want to unpack those two words a little bit. More. Faster. We love that. And like I told you, this has been going on for a very long time. Back in 1967, before I was born, by the way, back in 1967, the Senate convened a special committee chaired by Ted Kennedy. I had heard about this. I finally found the archive. I didn't go to D.C. I found it online. But I found the archive of this subcommittee. They were studying the effects of technology in the workplace and retirement age, because they were concerned that if people started retiring earlier, it's going to drain Social Security. Interesting, they didn't have to worry. Social Security drained somehow anyway, but they found several things that were pretty interesting. For example, they said technology, both labor and time saving, will change the way Americans work. Truth? Okay, yeah, I'll give them that. How about this? They said in 20 years, people will work an average of 32 weeks per year. Truth? No. How about this? At that point, Americans will average 22 hours of work per week. This is in the Senate record, folks. What about this? The average American will retire by the age of 40. Apparently, I'm late, but that would have been awesome. And this is probably the best observation they made. Within 20 years, the number one challenge Americans will face with regard to time is what to do with their excess time. Is that you? I don't know about you, but Parkinson's Law is alive and well in me. Parkinson's Law states that work expands to fill the space available for work. And when we all want the next device or the next app to save us. And when it creates space in our life, we don't use it for margin. If I can take a task at work and strip 5 hours of effort out of it because of what technology gives me, guess what happens? I fill that 5 hours up with more work. And you do too. And now we're juggling and saying, well, I got to get the kids over to this practice, and then I'll sit in the stands and I'll jump on that conference call while they're practicing and you know, really get good at my muting game. I mean, we do this all the time. More, faster. And when you connect that pressure of doing more and doing it faster with the ability you have literally in the palm of your hand, it kind of creates a little bit of anxiety, doesn't it? I mean, we start to see the things we ought to be doing, and we know we could do them, but sometimes we don't. I just can't bring myself to open my banking app because I can't even bring myself to look at the balance. You been there? I mean, we know what this feels like. So today, what I'd like to do is give you a different word for more and faster, and that is the word efficiency. You've heard that, right? Now, for those of you who deal with physics in the crowd, we're using my definition of efficiency today because I got the microphone. But you just go off and tell me how I'm wrong later. But to me, efficiency is the ability to do more and to do it faster. Over and over and over. We have technology cycles that promise us that over and over and over. And sometimes we get too efficient, or we create some byproduct of that that becomes difficult for us. So what I'd like to do in the bit of time we have remaining is give you three things, three lies that you might start to believe if you're really focused in on efficiency, because what happens is before we know it, we almost start to worship at the idol of efficiency. So let me give you three lies that are kind of an indicator that you might be bending the knee at that altar. And here's the first one. When we focus completely on efficiency, a lot of times we stop paying as much attention to being effective. We miss some of the little things. Here's what that looks like in your life. When we get hyper-efficient on everything, and we start to hydroplane through our marriages. We start to hydroplane through our parenting or our relationships with other people, and you never drift to a good spot, do you? I mean, when you are hydroplaning through all of that, it is a challenge. There is this really interesting and disturbing series of scriptures in Exodus. And I found it the first time I was going through the Bible in 1 year. And then I read this set of like 3 or 4 verses, and I am completely perplexed. Let me give you the framework of this. Moses, I mean, we're talking Exodus. I'm not even to the slow part of the Bible yet, okay? We aren't to Leviticus. We aren't to the last 35 chapters of Job. We are smack dab in Exodus, which is action-packed in a lot of ways. And I'm sitting there reading, and it's Moses going up to the first Instagram-worthy moment. He is seeing the burning bush that doesn't burn up. And he's told to remove his sandals because he's on holy ground, and so he does. And if he had had a device, he would have just put those sandals right in the front of the frame and taken a picture with the burning bush in the background and just subtitled it "My Current Situation." That was so Instagram worthy. But he argues with God. He negotiates with God like only a Hebrew can. And when God is finally done with him, he is on a mission. He is told, "You're going back to Egypt, and you're leading my people out." Now, this had to bring a little bit of anxiety to Moses, right? Because old Mo, he leaves Egypt, you know, 40 years ago on the run because he's a murderer. And he's been gone for 40 years. And now he has to go down from that burning bush and tell his wife, we're going on a trip. And I don't know when we're going to be back. And so they all pack up and they're on their way. And then this weird set of verses shows up. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched Moses' feet with it. "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me," she said, so the Lord let him alone. Ain't nobody saying amen to that scripture. We're all going to give a collective, ew, what is that? I mean, I remember reading that and thinking, God, you, now we can't use this in VBS. I mean, I was so disturbed by it. What in the world is going on? Why include this? And God, why did you just convince him to go and then try and kill him? And it took me a lot of living and getting kicked in the teeth a few times by this world to start to learn a little bit of a lesson and to realize, you know, if this is what he was intending to do, it is brilliant. Because I'm starting to think that God did not want any of us in 2025 to realize, he didn't want us to miss the point that sometimes when we get hyper-focused, hyper-efficient, hyper-on-task, we miss the little things, and the little things matter. Moses had not circumcised his son. There were no Ten Commandments at this point. The law had not been given, but there was one thing that indicated the covenant God made to Abraham, and all the Israelites were circumcising their babies, and Moses is about to go out and lead them out. What's that going to look like when he is there and he hadn't even followed that? The one thing, let me translate that Hebrew for you that Zipporah says when she says, "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." The Bible tells you what she meant by that. I'm going to give you the actual Hebrew translation. Hey, I did what you forgot to do. Because let's face it, guys, sometimes we get pretty hyper on task and focused, don't we? I mean, I might or might not have been accused of once in a while saying, "Come on, we were supposed to leave 10 minutes ago. We're going on vacation where it's going to be fun." Right? How many of you with small children had a great ride to church today? None of you. We live this life. We understand it. We are hollering at each other in the car. "Dad, you're speeding." "I know, but we got to get to church." And then you wheel in here on two wheels and say, "Brother Hodges, how are you? Good to see you, sir." I mean, we are good at this. But the reality is that we start to miss the little things. Let's keep moving. The second thing, the second lie that we start to believe sometimes when we really, really, really get efficient. The second lie is that we start to believe that efficiency and compassion can coexist well together. I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but the more efficient we get, sometimes the smaller our hearts get. And we try and make compassion efficient, don't we? We've tried real hard. We call it GoFundMe. And we turn compassion into a simple transaction. But where do we have the time? How do we have the time to do this? There is a great story in Luke 10, which I would love to read to you, but let me just give you the paraphrased version. Jesus is being tested by some people, and he comes back and he says, "Hey, let me tell you about this." And you'll see it in your Bible in Luke 10 with the header, "The Good Samaritan." If this had been published back then, they would not have said that. Because you see, they hated Samaritans. Samaritans were half-breeds. They were nothings. They were subhuman. And this guy is traveling, and he gets beaten up and robbed by thieves, and he is left for dead. They don't even have the common decency to hide the body. He is just a lump on the side of the road, and along comes a priest, a man of God, efficiently on his way to probably serve God or implement the law or whatever, and he sees the guy, and he races toward him, and he helps him out. No, that's actually not what happens in the story. He sees the guy, and he crosses the street. And then he continues on. And here comes a Levite. Not necessarily a priest, but part of the priestly tribe. And he sees the guy and he crosses over and he keeps going. And then here comes this Samaritan, a nobody, a nothing. And he sees this person, and I love the wording Jesus uses. He starts this guy's response with, he took pity on him. There is no room for pity in efficiency. Can we just all agree that really helping people is inefficient by nature? And he picks this guy up. He helps him bandage his wounds. He takes him to an inn. He basically tells the innkeeper, hey, I'll be coming back and, you know, take care of him. And anything else you spend, I'll hit you back on Venmo or whatever they used back then. I mean, we'll take care of it. But I'm telling you that one of the challenges we have is understanding that compassion and efficiency don't coexist well together. I'd love to take a quick poll. How many of you have seen either the musical, live, or the movie Wicked? Just raise them high. We're not taking pictures. Okay, a lot of you. Now, how many of you saw the original Wizard of Oz? Okay. Oh, that's still bigger. Okay. So my problem with the Wizard of Oz was they always ran, it was like Ten Commandments. They ran it on Sunday night, so I always missed the first hour, you know, growing up, because, you know, we had that whole church thing going on Sunday night. But here's the thing. In Baum's mythical tale, there's a lot in there that we didn't see in The Wizard of Oz, and we're seeing the backstory of the witches in Wicked, but there is also backstory to the Scarecrow and the Lion and the Tin Man, who was my personal favorite when I was like seven. But the Tin Man's story is interesting because he was a lot like us. He was just a human, and he was what they called a woodman. He cut trees. That's what he did. And he fell in love with this beautiful maiden. And so he decided, they decided they wanted to get married. He starts cutting trees to make them a house so that when they're married, they can live there. And the Wicked Witch hates this because, you know, she kind of had a thang for him. And so, you know, she starts getting incensed at his love for this woman. So she causes an accident to happen, and he accidentally chops off an arm. And so the tinsman comes and builds him a mechanical arm out of tin. Well, now he's really excited because this arm now does not get tired. It's more efficient. He's cutting more wood faster. So his love for this woman is growing. And then the witch is just keeps getting madder and madder and causes disaster after disaster after disaster. He loses his other arm. He loses both legs. And then the tinsman comes back and builds all those out, and now he's like a machine, and he's thinking, I can cut this forest. And, you know, he is so excited about marrying this woman. And so finally she causes one final awful accident to happen, and he splits his torso. It's a bad event, and the tinsman comes and replaces his torso. But the one thing the tinsman cannot give him is a heart. And this is why I finally figured out after reading through all that, he carries an axe through the whole movie. Now I get it. But there is this great quote from John Eldridge in his book, Waking the Dead, on this topic. Listen to this. Notice there was a man who was once real and alive and in love, but after a series of blows, his humanity was reduced to efficiency. He became sort of a machine, a hollow man. At first, he did not even notice, for his condition made him an excellent woodman, as any person can become productive like a machine when he forgoes his heart. Notice also that it was the Wicked Witch who brought the disaster upon him. Baum's mythic tale reminds us that the enemy knows how vital the heart is, even if we do not. And all his forces are fixed on its destruction. For if he can disable or deaden your heart, then he has effectively foiled the plan of God, which was to create a world where love reigns. And by taking out your heart, the enemy takes out you, and you are essential to that story. So, friends, I got to ask, how's your compassion meter looking these days? We are so efficient. How's it looking? How is your ability to take pity on people who need help? Does your time control you and not you controlling your time? We are too good at developing relationships thumb to thumb instead of face to face. My hope is that we could reclaim some of our heart and not lose it, because the device is not evil. And what it enables doesn't have to be evil, but when we start worshiping at that altar, then it can change us. Well, I'm going to give you the third lie, and then we'll wrap this up. Because there is a third great lie that if you're believing it, you might be bowing down to that altar. And that is the lie that we are in control. Because you think about it, the more efficient we get, the more we feel like we can bend things to our will. I can control this now. See, I can do this faster than ever before. And before you know it, you think you're in control. On July 28th, 2010, I almost lost my daughter. It was a Wednesday. And I remember I was at home because I was flying to New York the next day, and I decided I'm taking the day off. And she was working an internship over at City Connections when they were located out by the airport, when Jeff Spry had just kind of started that up. And so she would go drive downtown, take 6th Street, and just drive over there. And the phone rang, and I looked at caller ID, which, by the way, caller ID was this cool little box that we had attached to our phone that told you who was calling, and it said Little Rock Polk, and that was all the characters it had. But if you're a parent, you know. And I answered the phone, and I will never forget the sound of that female officer's voice saying, "Is this Mr. Hodges?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And she said, "Is your daughter Ashton Hodges?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Sir, your daughter's been in an accident, and she seems to be okay, but you might want to get down here." And so I grabbed Tamara, and we jumped in the car. We were living in Maumelle at the time, and that 22-minute drive literally took 12. And the only thing I remember about that drive was her grabbing my arm and saying, "We're not going to be any good to her if we're dead." She has a way with words. Hey, at least she didn't say you were indeed a bridegroom of blood to me. I mean, that would have been bad news. So we get there. See, what had happened was there was a guy who was stealing copper pipe and air conditioners from the old Job Corps building downtown. And the police were called, and they were chasing him. 6 police cars chasing this guy, and he blew through a stop sign and T-boned her, knocked her into a telephone pole, which cracked and fell on her car with live power lines, And so when we roll up, this is what I see. This is what ran on page 1B of the paper the next day. Either it was a slow news day or this was big news. But I don't know how to describe to you parents what it feels like to see your kid inside the police tape. And I don't know what my face looked like. I don't know what my face looks like now, because I'm using every bit of muscle mastery I might have in my face to not cry again. But I was standing there, and I will never forget, one of the police captains came up to me, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "Hey, buddy, look at me. Come on, look at me." And I looked at him, and he said, "We do this all the time. And I'm going to promise you, none of us are leaving until you and your girl and your family can leave together." And there was something that shifted in me that day. I don't know how to describe it. I felt it, but I don't know how to describe it. Because I went from a guy who was thinking I was in control to feeling like I was in pretty good hands. Now, I don't know if you have made that connection in the broader sense of your life, spiritually. But I'm going to tell you one great truth. No matter how much you may think you're in control, you are not. But you're in pretty good hands. And so today, I want you to know that Jesus looks at you. He looks at you, in the middle of all of your efficiency-driven anxiety. He looks at you in the middle of all the anxiety about how am I going to teach my kids how to use this technology safely, and I can't even keep up with it. He looks at you in the middle of your pain of losing a loved one and having to stare at that empty place at the table every day. He looks at you and he sees you in the middle of that broken relationship where there is hurt every minute of your day. He looks at you in any situation you are in. The Prince of Peace looks at you and he says, Hey, look at me. I do this all the time. And I'm going to promise you, I am not leaving you. In fact, I want you to come with me. I'm not leaving you even when you think I'm not there. I'm not leaving you when you're in your worst moments and you feel the most alone. I'm even not leaving you if you decide someday that you're not sure you believe in me. And if you turn and walk away from me, if at any point you will turn back, you're going to see me running to you because I'm not leaving you. The Prince of Peace is choosing to have a very inefficient relationship with you. And thank God he does. He is the one who keeps us in his hands. And it is okay. Technology can be great. Use it, but be its master. Exert your mastery over it. You want to be efficient? Be efficient. You know, in church, we would call efficiency being a good steward. No. This is more than that. Because the more we try and be efficient, the more we